What's up? Welcome to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. I'm Jamie Dodd. My co-host, of course, is Canucks insider Thomas Drantz, who also covers the team for The Athletic. Canucks Talk is brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We're live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. What's going on, Drantz?
Well, let's see if you can hear me, or if
I can.
Looks like I'm...
Success!
What was the guy who slowed it down to 0.75?
Yeah.
What did I say in that? It sounded like I was dead. Your description of me was, he's moving, but I can't tell that he's there or
yeah.
something.
Yeah, and I sounded high out of my mind. But we're referencing, somebody sent us a tweet. For some reason, I've heard of people listening to podcasts at like 1.5 speed. Like Bic is like that, a real sicko like that. I've never heard of somebody slowing it down. I don't know if we talk really fast or something. This guy has to, he said he was listening to us at 0.75 speed. And he shared a little clip of what that sounded like with us on Twitter. And we sounded really out of it. Let me tell you, when you slow us down even a little bit.
You sounded strung out and like vaguely concerned that the person you were with had died.
Yeah. Yeah. Stoned out of my mind is basically how I would
describe
it.
We'll get the drop. We'll get the drop for the listeners by the end of the segment.
But, okay, obviously this is Canucks Talk, and we will do a lot of just that, talking about the Canucks throughout the course of the show. We got a couple of good guests as well. Shayna Goldman and Jason Kukla are going to join us. But
always
I do
talking about the Canucks.
It's just like, that's what we do, you know? Anyways.
The show is.
We got to talk about Stanley Cup Final, Game 2 last night. A dominant defensive performance from the Florida Panthers against Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl, and we can talk about the attrition for the Oilers. They're wearing down. Is Draisaitl even healthy? But still, per natural stat trick at 5-on-5, zero high danger chances allowed by the Florida Panthers against a Connor McDavid-led team in the Stanley Cup Final. I'm still trying to wrap my mind around if that is just simply a phenomenal team-level defensive performance that helps them take the 2-0 series lead last night.
Well, and a huge departure from what we saw in Game 1, where the Oilers were blanked and yet generated a lot off the rush, a lot at 5-on-5, a lot on the power play. I mean, the Oilers were pretty unfortunate to not score at least a single goal, if not multiple ones in Game 1. And then in Game 2, you know, they were unlucky to not score on the power play, right? They hit a few posts. They looked threatening. Like, I'm definitely not buying the Panthers PK shutting down the Oilers power play line. But certainly the Oilers have their work cut out for them in terms of getting back to their game and getting back to generating 5-on-5. Look, there was a lot that went wrong for Edmonton in that game. I thought Bouchard, had a like night and day, right? Game 1, he was dominant. Game 2, he was poor.
Yep.
Certainly the McDavid line didn't have the same level of territorial dominance that they had against the Panthers in Game 1, even though they didn't score. There's signs of hope for them still. Like, I really like some of the work Zach Hyman's been able to do beneath the hash marks, kind of like regularly using his speed to beat Ekblad and regularly using his size to beat Gustav Forsling. On the PDO cast today, I referred to him as like the Mario in Mario Kart in some of those battles against that defense pair. But the, you know, fundamental truth is, in my mind, you know, we're two games deep in the series and the Oilers' third line has surrendered 3 goals against and everything else is kind of a wash. It's like the Oilers' top players haven't made a difference, but kind of neither have the Panthers' players at even strength, right? They've mostly been bottled up. 1 goal from Florida's top 6 forward lines. I mean, if that continues, that's in Edmonton's favor. Unless, right, this Lundell, Lusterainen, and Tarasenko line with guys like Evan Rodriguez doing the depth scoring keep putting up margin. And, you know, we've been kind of waiting for this to potentially happen, right? It happened a little bit to Derek Ryan, but only to Derek Ryan against the Stars. For the most part, the third and fourth lines have held. The Canucks weren't able to punish the McLeod line with the frequency they needed to if they were going to offset what McDavid and Bouchard were generating. And the Panthers have through 2 games, and That's a big reason, in addition to Sergei Bobrovsky. And what you know, I wouldn't say necessarily it's just about the Oilers getting goalied. I also think their shooters have been wasteful. Like, I think there's an interplay there. But, you know, I think between Edmonton struggling to convert and struggling to get to break out, right, which is something we talked about a lot in the lead up to the series, right? The Panthers just did to the Oilers what the Canucks did to the Oilers in Game 5. Like, fundamentally, that's what we saw in Game 2, where their down-ice pressure just bottled the Oilers up so significantly they weren't able to get going, and if you can't get going, you can't generate. Your offense is cut up, cut apart at the stem. That's what the Panthers were able to accomplish last night, and yet, you know, again, we saw that happen to the Oilers in Game 5 against Vancouver, and what happened next, right? Just, like, their best game in Edmonton. Game 7, completely dominant for 52 minutes. So, you know, this one ain't over, but certainly the Panthers' edge as sort of a defensive team, a forechecking team, a high-pressure team, and especially as it's shown up against the middle ranks and the bottom end of the Edmonton lineup, it's been decisive so far. And, you know, as I said before the series, I expect it to be decisive in this series. Ultimately,
it's certainly not over. No Canucks fans, I think, need me to use the 2-0 lead after the two games at home example. We all know how that can go sideways.
Ouch.
In a hurry.
Ouch.
I mean, I gotta say, I should have been expecting it, but I definitely wasn't quite expecting just as many tweets about that last night as I saw. Kind of caught me a little bit off guard yesterday, which is probably my fault. But the concern isn't so much what Florida did in Game 2, because as you said, look, we've seen Edmonton bounce back from poor performances with really, really good ones already. Momentum doesn't carry over. They're going back home. They got a couple of days off to regroup here. So the concern isn't so much that. For me, the concern is more just how worn down Edmonton might be at this point, right? And, you know, Darnell Nurse injured, leaves the game, right? Can't play anymore. Evander Kane, super ineffective, obviously playing through a ton of pain, a ton of injuries. Injury situations right now. Evan Bouchard has been logging such big minutes, and as you said, you know, had a poor night last night, right? Are the minutes starting to catch up to him, and is Leon Draisaitl right? And you start going through the whole list, and is it going to just come down to, can they get a kind of superhuman performance from Connor McDavid to win 4 of the next 5? Now, if you had to bank on anyone to do it, it would be Connor McDavid, right? So I'm not going to write them off at this point. But the concern for me isn't so much, hey, they were roundly outplayed by Florida in Game 2, because they outplayed Florida, you could argue, in Game 1. It's just how much gas is left in the tank for them now to pull off a really dramatic comeback over the final 5 games, potentially, of this series. And I think that's where there's truly a lot of warning signs. Like, are they going to have what they need to win 4 of the next 5 when you look at the state of some of their key players right now?
Well, and, you know, we talked about this a lot as that Canucks series went along, and we're seeing it sort of on steroids in this series, which is, you know, to this point, Evan Bouchard through 2 games. So we're not talking about like a huge, we're only talking about a small cut of hockey.
Mm-hmm.
To this point, total minutes, all situations, Bouchard has logged 10 more minutes than Gustav Forsling, who's the Panthers' leading defensive ice time guy. Like, that's a big gap for just 2 games.
Yep.
And I'd add this, Connor McDavid has logged more minutes than Gustav Forsling, the Florida Panthers' top defenseman, by 4 minutes through 2 games. So certainly there's some grist for the mill if you want to do the Oilers are wearing down thing, and yet, you know, make no mistake, right? Like, you empty the tank in Game 3, you find a way in Game 4, we're not going to be talking about this being like a comeback. You know, like, we're not going to be talking about this being a comeback by the time you're in Game 5 if you're able to take care of business on home ice. So, and, you know, everyone's fatigued. The Oilers, you know, almost lost Luis Duranen, may have in fact lost Sasha Barkov.
Yep.
We'll see, right? So, you know, I think it's on both sides. We saw last year in the Stanley Cup final just how injured the Florida Panthers were, how much they were compromised as that series went along. I don't get the sense that we're there yet with Edmonton, like the true, like, you know, parts of the car falling off as it crosses the finish line thing that we saw from the Panthers last year. It doesn't feel like either team's there yet, but we could definitely get there in a hurry. And I think we could get there in a hurry on either side. So certainly the minutes burden for the Oilers' top players. It's been a storyline all playoffs. It's going to keep being a storyline. I mean, this has been a pretty remarkable athletic feat from that group to even get here, and they need to find a way to win, what, four of the next – I guess they need to win four of the next five.
Four to five, yep.
Tough.
Tall order against a really, really good Florida team who, as you said, you know, one of the key differences for Florida this year versus last is they're just in so much better health this year. And I think you're right. I don't think Edmonton is where Florida was last year against Vegas. And I think in particular, like McDavid, I'm sure he's playing through stuff. But I mean, Matthew Tkachuk was, I forget exactly what the injury was, but he was like barely functional in the Stanley Cup final against Vegas because he was so hurt. Right. So at the top of the lineup.
And the 2D.
Yeah.
Right? Both Ekblad and Montour were held together by ticky-tack by the end or, you know, whatever it is, sticky tape. And then they had to, and then they both had surgery and weren't even ready for the start of the year, right? I mean, those were long-term injuries that they were just trying to get across the finish line with. We'll see. There have been whispers for months now that Dreisaitl and McDavid have been playing hobbled themselves.
Yeah.
So... and to this point, it hasn't stopped them from being remarkable, outrageously good. So I'm not betting against the Oilers' top players. What I am kind of betting against is that Florida's such a monster defensively, just such a beast in terms of being, effectively an 18-man shutdown unit with a pretty good goalie.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think that's overwhelming Edmonton to this point, especially because last night anyway, you know, Barkov was able to actually like play with McDavid, force him to defend. It's not just that the Oilers, it's not just that the Panthers have more depth. It's that they also can match them at the top end, or at least have for the most part through two games in aggregate. And even still, Jamie, like Dreisaitl and McDavid, like +5, +4 in terms of the shots on goal. It's really at the bottom end with their bottom six centers on the ice. That's where the Oilers have been outscored 3-0 and outshot 12-6, right? So it's like, is Edmonton just a little too flawed for their top players to make a difference? Maybe, but their top players haven't made the difference on the scoreboard yet. So it's tough for me to like take that one to the bank.
Well, and of course, one of the stats going around from last night, only three Edmonton forwards with a shot on goal, right? And you just look at, Henrik, Janmark, Connor Brown, Dylan Holloway, Evander Kane, Ryan McLeod, Sam Carrick. I know Warren Fogle left, but like all of the combined for zero shots between them. And that's a really, really tough way to survive against another elite team like Florida. Now, you brought up the total team defense from Florida. But of course, leading the charge in that regard is the Selke winner, Sasha Barkov, whose status is at least partly in question. I did see the update from Paul Maurice today, or at least a little bit of an update, says it looks like it's trending in the right direction for Barkov. Obviously, I'll know a lot more tomorrow and then on Thursday on game day. But Maurice seemed to have a bit of an optimistic tone anyways, which I think is important. Somebody texted it in here. If Barkov is concussed and can't play, then sprint to go bet the Oilers to come back in this series. It would still be a really phenomenal uphill battle, obviously, even with Barkov out. But Barkov is so key to the identity of that team, the defensive identity of that team, the ability to credibly go out there and play with Connor McDavid. If the door was to be open even a little bit for the Oilers, it feels like it would be as a result of either a compromised Alexander Barkov or a Barkov who's absent. So that one bears watching. And then, of course, the other conversation is the conversation around the Dreisaitl hit, which is the reason we're talking about Barkov and his concussion status in general. Everything I've seen online from Wyshynski, from others, seems to be do not expect any supplementary discipline or a suspension for Leon Dreisaitl, which certainly seems correct to me. Maybe that changes if Barkov is not able to go, although that doesn't seem to be the case either. But I would just be very, very surprised. Very surprised, given that what I know about the NHL, if there was any suspension whatsoever for Leon Dreisaitl.
You get to about 10 a.m. Pacific time the day after a game without a hearing being scheduled, and you know you're probably not getting a suspension. The obviously that's good reporting work from Wyshynski and Renaud Lavoie and some of the other people who've tweeted it, but like also you kind of know, like when you wake up in the morning, but by about 9, 10 a.m., by the time you're done, your first task at work, there's either a hearing scheduled or it's very rare for a player to be suspended. It's a tough one for me. Like, I think Dreisaitl probably knew what he was doing. Like, I think that was probably a dirty elbow. Mm-hmm. But you know, I also thought the nature of the hit, Barkov's literally trying to play the puck. He's a little bit crouched. Dreisaitl comes in high, but he tucks his elbow. And then, you know, to me, it's like fringes of a major penalty. It probably should have been a major penalty. I probably lean there, but not with more than like 60-40, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And if we're only on the fringes of a major, if I'm watching it in my head being like, ah, I think that should be a major, then it's probably not suspension worthy, even if it does ultimately injure Barkov, which sucks. It's one of those hits, you know, that occurs within the game, and it's close, and you can see the player case or the DOPS case for it being a player accident. And I hate it. I hate everything about that hit. And yet in response to it, you know, this is one thing the Panthers have played with fire doing across this series to this point is they haven't been disciplined.
Mm-hmm.
They've taken Sam Bennett's back to averaging an offensive zone penalty a game, stuff like that. Well, there's no, like, last night was the perfect example where, you know, the first period, it's like, oh man, the Panthers are about to blow the Oilers off the ice until the Oilers take a major penalty, right? And it's like, well, that shouldn't be in their favor, but it very much is, because the Panthers looked last night like they were on the power play at 5-on-5 and then looked like they were down a man when they were up 5-4, right? Like, it was wild. Obviously, Evan Rodriguez ended up ending the Oilers PK's incredible streak, but, you know, the fact remains, the moment this game transitions to special teams, it favors the Oilers. Yep. So, you know, if it, like, so much different stuff to unpack here. If Barkov's in, great, then I do think it's key for the Panthers to put aside, like, the vengeance you want is to lift a mug above your head.
You're two games away from winning the Stanley Cup, right? And Hans texted in, if Barkov is out, 97 and 29 will need to grow eyes at the back of their heads. It's going to be ugly. And now he's saying if Barkov is out, and I can understand that, right? Do you try to push the envelope a little bit because you say, hey, the standard's been set, right? Stars are fair game. But ultimately, like, this season, this isn't even, you're not trying to change the momentum. You're up. Like, you have a chance to theoretically end this by Saturday night if you win the next two games. That has to be the focus, right? You cannot allow yourself to go chasing Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl if you're the Florida Panthers here.
Especially because the Oilers are, you know, there's a margin between the Oilers and everyone else on special teams. You cannot let this game be decided on special teams. The Oilers have been deeply unfortunate with, like, five posts hit and a missed. By the way, Ryan Nugent-Hopkins misses as Sergei Bobrovsky channels Star Fox and does a barrel roll. And why is everyone playing that replay like it was saved? It's been driving me nuts.
You're asking the wrong guy.
I've never seen a miss.
I don't know.
I've never seen a miss played, like, both in terms of, like, social media graphics and on highlight shows, as if it's like evidence of Bobrovsky. Ryan Nugent-Hopkins missed the net. What are we doing here? That's not a goalie highlight. Driving me nuts.
But it looks cool.
It's just like, it is cool. But, like, you know, it's an example of Bobrovsky's readiness to take on Andros and save the galaxy. And that's about it. They cannot let this be decided on special teams. They have to park any idea of retribution. And I also don't want to minimize, like, I think if Barkov's, you know, it's like, honestly, for me, it's kind of like when the Canucks lost Brock Besser, it compromised them fundamentally in terms of their ability to, like, just threaten regularly as an offensive team, just because they only, you know, they were already short maybe two true talent top six forwards and two true talent top line forwards. And you remove the one, you know, you remove one of both and yikes. It looked tough in that seventh game against the Oilers. For me, like, you bump Bennett up to play McDavid. That's tough. Mm-hmm. Now you're probably bumping Lundell up to play Dreisaitl. That's tough. And now you don't have the Lundell, Tarasenko, Luostarinen edge that's been so important for you against McLeod and company. You're probably, you know, cobbling something together, maybe dropping Evan Rodriguez down the lineup and sort of hurting your top six a bit. You know, it's really hard to understate just how important Barkov versus McDavid has been in these two games and how crucial Barkov's been on the power play or the penalty kill. I think you lose that. I think this series changes entirely. Like, I think it's hard to understate how important Barkov's presence, even at 80%, is in the Panthers lineup in this series.
And the other thing is, you know, from an offensive standpoint, it's not like the Panthers generated a ton last night of 5-on-5 either, right? So, like, Barkov hurts from that perspective as well. They don't have a lot of margin for error in terms of the offensive side and what they're doing either. And by the way, I referenced some tweets earlier from Greg Ushinsky at ESPN saying it didn't sound like Leon Draisaitl was going to get suspended. He is now reporting full stop. Leon Draisaitl avoids suspension or fine for Barkov game two hit. And I did get an email from the NHL Department of Player Safety just a few minutes ago that was the Oilers' Sam Carrick has been fined for slashing. So once you start getting the Department of Player Safety announcements about other incidents from the game and there's no mention of anything like that. So again, as you said, pretty clear indicator that do not expect any supplemental discipline for Leon Draisaitl. And then you just hope that not just from a Panthers perspective, but from a hockey fan perspective, that Barkov is 100% good to go, or at least as close to 100% as anybody is, but that the concussion specifically is not giving him any issues, and he's good to go at full health, so we can continue seeing the top end of these teams' lineups go at each other in the Stanley Cup Finals, which the Florida Panthers now lead 2-0 after, again, a dominant defensive performance down in Florida last night. Okay, we will take a break. Keep the text coming in. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. We'll talk a little bit more Stanley Cup Final with Shayna Goldman from The Athletic. Shayna also had a good piece looking at RFA situations around the NHL earlier this week, so we can chat with her about that. And, of course, the Canucks have a high-profile RFA of their own in Philip Pronick, and then Jason Buchla joins us at 1 o'clock. More Canucks talk coming up here on Sportsnet 650.
Hey, it's Big Nizar. Have your say and join me on The People's Show with big takes and even bigger bets weekdays 3 to 4 on Sportsnet 650 or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd. It's Thomas Drantz here with you. Canucks Talk is brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We're live from the Kintec Studio. 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street, or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center, or Arbutus in Vancouver, online at dunbarlumber.com. As Drantz fiddles with his headphones there, we got you, Drantz?
Yeah, hi.
Hello.
Killing it.
Were you wearing the wrong headphones or something? What happened there?
I was wearing the wrong headphones.
Amazing, amazing.
I was like, what's going on? This is a problem. Anyway, fast work by me to solve the problem.
So good. I saw a panicked text killing in the group chat and then the rapid shuffle of the headphones on camera. Sorry to out you there, but that was delightful.
Oh, no, all good. Shayna, all good. I deserve it.
Shayna Goldman from The Athletic is going to join us here. Do we have Shayna on the line, guys? No, Dom is going to now effort to get Shayna on the line. Perfect timing from
we're making moves
producer Dom Shermati. Oh, okay. I'm excited for that. But we'll get Shayna on the line momentarily from The Athletic, get her thoughts on the Stanley Cup Final, which the Florida Panthers now lead 2-0 over the Edmonton Oilers. And then, of course, Jason Buchla, our guy, will join us. One, I should note, Buchla joining us today on a Tuesday, not a Wednesday. We got the day off tomorrow, Drantzer. Very exciting. The Blue Jays are playing a day game. We're playing that on the station. We get a little bonus Wednesday off. So looking forward to that. It does mean no crossover this week. We'll reconnect. We got a week off for everyone to, I don't know, cool down a little bit, I guess, or whatever. Just have some distance from each other, and we'll reconnect with our pals Donnie and Dolly next week on the show. But as mentioned, right now, we're very pleased to be joined from The Athletic by Shayna Goldman, also from the Too Many Men podcast. Shayna, thank you as always for doing this. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. And we were talking at length about Game 2 of the Stanley Cup Final in our first segment. And, you know, I think for me, there's so many talking points obviously coming out of it with Barkov's status, the Dreisaitl hit. Doesn't look like he's going to be suspended. But the biggest takeaway for me was just what a defensive masterclass from a team-wide perspective that was for the Florida Panthers, limiting a high-powered, potent Edmonton Oilers team led by Connor McDavid to, as I said, per natural stat trick, zero high-danger chances at 5-on-5 in that game.
Yeah, that was definitely the standout. Like, they weren't allowing Edmonton to get to the middle of the ice much at all. You could see, like, that slot was pretty clear if you look at, like, any shot chart or heat map, which, you know, for Edmonton is pretty uncharacteristic, especially when you consider who's leading the way in their lineup. It's huge for the Panthers, and they did it in a way that they wear down their opponents. You know, that's like, I think, one of their best strengths. They're this really strong and physical team that can wear down their opponents and play defense in such a smart, proactive way. They're disruptive. They use their stick, smart positioning, and then they push the pace of play back to the other end of the ice. And that's exactly what they did. You know, they didn't need to pour on the shots and chances, which we've seen them do in this postseason. And I'm sure, you know, if they have another dominant game like that, we'll see a little bit more of that in this series. But they still just outpaced their opponent. They played like quintessential Panthers hockey. And, you know, you saw it in all different ways. And we're seeing how good they are at, you know, getting the puck out of their own zone and coming up the ice in transition. And I feel like it's something we almost forget they're so good at, because we all, you know, instantly think of the forecheck because it really redefined how they played last year. But they're still such a good team in transition as well.
Well, and I think they really, the key thing for the Panthers is there's so little distinction between like defending through the forecheck and defending in their own zone. You know what I mean? Like, when we say a team is really good defensively, I think we still automatically think, oh, they're really structured in their own zone, right? And they don't have those breakdowns. But for the Panthers, like, the way they're able to really suppress what the other team is doing offensively, yes, they're elite in their own zone, but as you said, it's also, they're an incredible forechecking team, so the other team can't really get started up the ice, and then they're so good in the neutral zone as well. So they kind of show, like, it's not enough just to be really, really good at defending your own zone. You have to be locked in playing that way in all three zones on the ice if you're going to have that kind of level of success like the Panthers did last night.
Yeah, like, you're speaking my language right here. Like, I love this. When we talk about defense in today's game, like, we can't just focus on the defensive zone. It's all about how do you make defensive plays in the offensive zone to regain possession and just extend your zone time. Like, people don't think of that as defense sometimes when it's a crucial part of it. Like, if the puck's not on your stick and you're finding ways to get it back, that, to me, you know, you're defending. If you're stopping them from exiting and breaking out with control, you're defending. So, yeah, it definitely is such a huge part of it, and they're good at it in all three zones, and they can do it up and down their lineup, you know, and that's a huge thing. It's not like you go from the top of their lineup and their top of their blue line, and there's such a stark difference from the bottom. Like, I'm not saying Forsling and Alfred Ekman Larson are one in the team, but it's how they all buy into the same system, and it's how they control the deployment of everyone to put them in a place to succeed, that they are allowed to play this way on both ends of the ice, and I think that's so huge for them.
Are you here for taking it one step further, Shayna, and including defending while holding the puck in the offensive end as part of team defense? Let's go.
Absolutely. Think of the play, I think it was first period last night, right? Like, Barkov's in the corner, and just the way he's not letting McDavid get near the puck. And, you know, just the fact that you're defending your own possession is important, because it's a way you're preventing your opponent from ever having the puck, is a way of stopping them from creating scoring chances. And that is like the whole reason why talking about defense is such a challenging thing to do, because it's not just stopping something that's already in motion, but it's stopping something from ever happening in the first place. If you can protect the puck and play the way, yeah, you're defending. Absolutely. And they, again, this is a team that's built to do that.
Has there been anything from these first two games in aggregate, not just from last night, but how these first two games have played out, that has surprised you based on what you expected the series to look like?
I'm a little surprised how quiet, like, Nugent Hopkins and Hyman are, because we're all going to talk about Connor McDavid. And I think as much as they're doing a good job keeping him quiet and slowing him down, he's not fully contained, and we're still seeing him have these, like, moments of magic. And I won't be surprised if on home ice he takes over a game, right? Like, I'm not as worried about him. And I think last night, and in game one, really, like, we saw Draisaitl with a ton of chances, even, you know, from up high in his new office. Like, I think that those players were standing out. But I was a little surprised that, you know, the high-end supporting cast isn't popping off as much, because those are the players that the Oilers need to click, right? Like, we know their bottom six isn't the most inspiring. We know they have some issues on defense. And we know, like, that top five-man unit, or, you know, their top four stars are always going to thrive. But I'm just a little surprised that, you know, they haven't made their mark yet. And it's a credit to the Panthers for a lot of it. So I'm wondering if we see them kind of pick up the pace next game.
How concerned are you about the idea of attrition starting to set in for the Oilers a little bit, right? Like, we know the minutes load that their top players carry, obviously with McDavid and Draisaitl, but Bouchard's been playing huge minutes as well. And, you know, he struggles a little bit last night. Then you go down to the more of the supporting members. Darnell Nurse leaves the game. Evander Kane is obviously playing through something. And look, they still have Connor McDavid, right? So I'm far from counting them out, but it does feel like just the slog of the postseason is maybe starting to catch up to the Oilers a little bit more than it is the Florida Panthers right now.
Yeah, and like, this was a thing last year too. Like, they ran 11 forwards and 70 for a lot of the season, and they performed better. But at the deadline, like, they made a point to ensure they had that 12th forward, because you can't expect everybody to load up on their minutes through a full season and through not just one, but two or two. It's four rounds of the playoffs now. You're asking for that. It's a huge deal. I think having a healthy body as a 6D man will help. And there, you know, it will it be Nurse? Who's to say? Will it be CC? Like, it's going to be really interesting to see. Like, I know already it's like, well, Nurse played through that hip flexor last year in the postseason. He's done it before. But if he is not capable of playing enough minutes, can you truly allow him to do it? Is he helping or hurting more than Cody Ceci will? And it's a really tough question to ask, honestly. And up front, it'll help them to have Fogel for a full game. You know, he's not getting suspended, so in theory, they're going to have at least 11 capable forwards and won't be down to 10 with the Kane injury. It's going to be a tough one to go through, because you need depth. And it's kind of the exact opposite on the other side of this matchup, right? You know, the Panthers were the team that got to the Stanley Cup final, and they were so hurt by the time they got there, and it only added up pretty quickly against Vegas. This year, they credit their balanced approach for why they're not limping into the Stanley Cup final. And it's something for the Oilers to take away from this, if that is ultimately what burns them.
Yeah, and it really feels like, okay, obviously there's the issues with at forward, and, you know, the kind of high-level support players like Nugent Hopkins and Hyman need to step up. But looking on the blue line for Edmonton, it feels like they're just really missing that third defenseman they can rely on. Not that they need a third defenseman to be a star, right? But they're going to play Bouchard a ton. They're going to play Ekholm a lot. You would love to, you know, whether it was Darnell Nurse, if he was healthy and performing, to be that third guy you can trust. But just after that, it feels like a lot of kind of crossing their fingers. And, you know, I like Brett Kulak. Like, I think there's other talented players on the blue line, but it just doesn't seem like the level of trust or the kind of impact is there once you get beyond Bouchard and Ekholm. And that, man, that's a really, really tough way to play against a team with as much talent as the Florida Panthers.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, you're going up against a deep team with at least three scoring lines. Like, that is really tough to say, okay, one defense player is going to contain that all. And, like, the big problem the Oilers have is that they can't spread the wealth, right? Like, Ekholm and Bouchard have played together pretty exclusively since Ekholm joined the Oilers, and for good reason. He helps Bouchard be the best version of himself. And, you know, I think sometimes we're a little harsher on Bouchard. Well, not we, but some people are harsher on Bouchard because when he makes a mistake, it's so glaring. Mm-hmm. And with offensive defenders, we always hear about the lapses, you know, in defense and how they need an anchor. But, like, Ekholm's so good that he really does complete his game, and they're both pushing each other to be better. We don't know what they look like without each other. And, like, in a perfect world, you would have a scenario where if you needed to, you could split them up and say, okay, we're going to spread the wealth and do it that way. But I don't think you can. So now you're really struggling to get through those bottom four pairs. And, like, I agree with you. I think Kulak is a good defenseman, but there's a reason that trust isn't there. And while they couldn't have anticipated Nurse getting hurt and not being able to be that number three, it's if you anticipate going on a deep run, you need to have options that you can trust. And I know technically they have seven bodies, but that trust isn't there and no one's earned it. So it just goes back to the deadline of, like, why didn't you get somebody? Just a guy. It doesn't have to be a perfect number three, but somebody that you could trust to go out there when your top pair's off the ice, just to have that extra support. And then if you need it, you know, you should have seven or eight guys out there ready for the playoffs. You shouldn't just be relying on six. And now it's even worse for them. So it's not a good problem to have.
Can I sell you on this? Because I actually think they need to try splitting Ekholm and Bouchard. They're just getting too bogged down against the Panthers' forecheck with their second and third pairs on the ice. Can I interest you in a little Broberg, Bouchard, Kulak? Kulak, Bouchard. No, Broberg, Bouchard. Kulak has to play the right side, I guess, with Ekholm. We know he doesn't want to do it. Can I interest you in that?
Well, Kulak has shifted to the right earlier in this postseason too, right? Didn't he do that to play with Nurse? They shifted him, and it was like
he did
for, against Dallas. It was okay.
Broberg. Yeah, he was okay, but I don't think he was comfortable. So it's been Broberg on the right side. But I do think they're going to need to split these pairs up just because they have 3D right now, maybe 3.5 if we count Kulak as a half, that I kind of trust to handle the Panthers' down-ice pressure. And it's Broberg's one of them. It's Ekholm, it's Bouchard, it's Broberg. I think they have to go with a top four approach here because they're getting bogged down. Like that is going to kill them if it happens again.
If I'm them, I don't think it's bad to practice that way and give it a shot. And even if you start with your usual defense pairs that they intend, have that in your back pocket to swap to. And I think I'm not blaming them for not splitting up Bouchard Ekholm in season because they were so good together. And I do totally get that. But when you lock up your playoff spot, like the best coaches, I think, start experimenting. Like think about the year that Colorado won. They knew they were in. They knew they were fine with their standing, that they were able to just start flip-flopping their lines to kind of figure out what other options do they have. So if they get stopped, like they did the year before, they had some ideas in their back pocket, and the players had just an ounce of familiarity with each other, and the coaches knew what worked, what might not work. And that definitely hurt the Oilers. And I know they were vying to finish high, and, they were still in the whole mess of the Pacific and the Western Conference. So it's not so easy to say, okay, you're in, now start experimenting because you still want to try to get home ice and everything. But it feels like it's a lesson for teams to just have a little versatility so you can prepare, right? Like, and some of that goes into roster building. You have to make sure that you have players who can play both sides or play different positions, whatever it might be. But within that, it doesn't hurt to have just a better idea, right? Of if this doesn't work, we can go this way. So practice that way. Maybe don't start the game that way, but be prepared to make necessary changes, because at least they control the matchups in game three. Is that going to help a ton with how deep Florida's lineup is? I'm not sure. You still have to deal with potentially Barkov and Tkachuk on different lines. And if Barkov doesn't play, it's a different story. That maybe they can feel that they can handle the matchup game as they're currently constructed. But why not be ready to make a swap, right? Like, you have to be creative. And I think Chris Knobloch's been pretty good at making lineup changes when necessary. So we'll see if he does it again.
You wrote this week about some RFAs, some key RFAs, 15 that people should be aware of. And Philip Peronik, factored in prominently. Here's what you wrote, and then we'll discuss it. With its cap situation and team needs in mind, Vancouver can't afford to pay him anything near his market value, which you suggest is $7.7 million on average over the next 6 years. Something in the $6 million range could be more palatable. The problem is the player is coming off of a $5.5 million salary this year, and anything in the low sixes won't seem like much of a raise. And in this case, Peronik has leverage. How much do you think the return of cap growth impacts a player like Hronik's thinking, given that he's got arbitration rights? If he's selling you UFA years, like, they better be priced pretty significantly, given the options that I'll have a year ago in a 90 plus million dollar upper limit environment as a 27-year-old right-handed defender. How much more complicated does that factor, do you think, make some of these negotiations?
It definitely does, right? And if you're a right-handed defenseman, one of the most coveted positions in this league, like if you're that or a top six center, you better be using that to your advantage. Like, you need to advocate for yourself in this league. No one knows how long their careers are going to be or what's going to happen. Like, you should be pushing for that. And I know players get, like, villainized for it, but they really shouldn't. You know, villainize the teams and be mad at them. They're, you know, they're the ones with the deeper pockets. But, yeah, he should keep that in mind. And, like, even though he had a pretty playoffs and end of regular season, like, you know, he's got to know too, like, hey, I worked with Quinn Hughes here and I helped him become the player that he was this year, because he did. He was his best, you know, teammate yet. And, you know, I read this really good article in The Athletic about how, you know, Quinn Hughes even credited Philip Peronis for it. So it was a really nice outline of that situation that helped, you know, inform me for this story. So I think that plays into it too. Like, you need to use that to your advantage. You have to use everything in your arsenal to your advantage, because so many general managers look at RFAs and go, well, you don't have rights, when in this case he does, and he can, you know, try to do something with them.
Yeah, and the thing about his success with Quinn Hughes is really what makes it such a sticky situation for the Canucks, right? Because you have a player that, look, we can look at it from the outside and say, hey, it's Quinn Hughes driving the bus there. He's the more talented one, obviously. You know, he's probably going to win the Norris here. But if Quinn Hughes himself is saying, no, Phil Peronis played a huge role in the season that I had, that makes it a lot more complicated from management's perspective. But, you know, I've gone back and forth, and Drance and I have debated this one. The long-term number that it would probably take to sign Phil Peronis makes me very, very nervous, as you alluded to in your piece as well. But the prospect of moving on from him and trying to replace that hole on the right side makes me very, very nervous as well. And, like, this is just one of those situations where I'm not sure there's a slam dunk, obvious, correct move from the Canucks' perspective.
Yeah, there really isn't, because if you look to the open market, you're already looking at older players, which you don't want to do. Like, you know, you have to, like, walk that line pretty carefully with aging curves in mind, and how much players tend to get overpaid in unrestricted free agency too, because you have to sway them to sign with your team. That's why this window is such a big deal. What works in the Canucks' favor is that players usually don't get their market value, especially if they're restricted free agents. That's the number if they were to hit the open market, which isn't happening here. Obviously, then he could just push for the one-year deal, and then there's a whole can of worms for next year. But to me, I look at it, like, if you can keep him in the low sixes, that is gold, right? That is as good as it gets. But if you go in the mid sixes, and it still is, like, $1 million range in from the $5.5 million salary to, like, a $6.5 million cap hit, like, it's a little bit of an overpayment, but, like, I feel like that's something with creativity you can work around. It's tough because, like, the Canucks don't have, like, a ton of space to work with, and they don't want to bog down their books right now, and I totally get that. But, you know, I think that there could be a compromise that doesn't completely suck for everyone. Maybe it's not perfect, but, I mean, what cap situation is, especially when we're talking about right-handed defensemen, right?
So you brought up, just one more from us, Shanna, you brought up top six centers and you know, top pair right-handed D as sort of the people with the most leverage. And they're also, you know, the main reason is that they're also the hardest to replace. And this is sort of where, you know, there's not a model that we use at The Athletic or that an analytics person would have that would suggest that 7x7 for Lindholm makes a lick of sense for the Canucks. And yet, when you really think about their options, when you really think about what Alexander Wenberg will cost, or what options might be out there to trade, you know, like, would the Montreal Canadiens consider moving Christian Dvorak? Like, once you get to that point, I think it begins to make sense why the Canucks would want to pay Lindholm. What's your take on this?
It depends on, like, what capacity they plan to use him as, right? Like, do they shift Miller away from center and make Lindholm their 2C? Like, someone's going to be unhappy there, but that's a number that could make sense as a top six winger. I don't know if it makes enough sense to spend that much as a 3C, but then again, like, we know he clicks. It, you know, wasn't even the perfect fit post-deadline, but I feel like a lot of signs could point to him bouncing back and being a good fit for a while. I don't know if that's the player I would want to commit 7 years to, honestly, but it's not the biggest deal in the world if they do, right? Like, they don't have a ton of options. It's a position they have to fill. It'll be interesting if they can kind of get this in before free agency starts, because someone like Chandler Stephenson might get paid more than he should because he has a cup you know, behind him, and, you know, he's a good speedy center that can be trusted in any situation. It's never easy with centers. It really isn't. Like, sometimes it would be nice if you could see those, like, 1 or 2 year deals and things like that. Even, like, things like the Gavrikov contract for the Kings. Like, it was a little bit weird. You're like, oh, that's expensive for 2 years, but it makes sense, too, for a team, yeah, especially. Like, you don't have to commit. But I feel like we're seeing that trend pop up with defensemen, not forwards. Like, we're not – it was the same thing with the Orlov contract. It's a short-term deal with more money than you'd expect for the player to get. So if they have to trade off term or money, I think that, you know, they can make it work. But obviously you don't want to see them sink both into someone who might be just a third-line center.
Shayna,
I think it's an important position. I don't want to knock it. Sorry. But you know what I mean.
No, that's the thing with third-line center. It is so important, but you also can't pay $7 million plus. It doesn't feel like even with cap growth, I don't think we're in that universe yet where that's a comfortable thing for a team to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm
all right. Shayna, appreciate the time as always. Thank you for doing this, and hopefully we can chat again soon.
Thanks for having me.
That is Shayna Goldman from The Athletic and the Too Many Men podcast joining us here, weighing in on the Stanley Cup final and the RFA situation with Filip Hronek specifically. And, you know, it's interesting because I thought we saw RFA situations get so hairy over the course of the flat cap, right? And you can think about the Brock Besser situation here, right? Like, it was such a sticking point, but that happened all around the league, right? And we saw good players get non-tendered or not offered qualifying offers and go to UFA.
Yeah, like 20 a year.
Yeah, right? And, like, guys were really good and have become effective players. Like, Dylan Strome, right? Like, guys were just, no, we can't afford this. And I was wondering, like, will the cap growth reduce the tension and reduce kind of some of the hairiness of it? But at your point is that, well, now we can see more cap growth on the horizon. So if you're an RFA thinking about selling UFA years, you have to be so, so cautious about doing that and making sure you're not undercutting yourself.
Well, and I think you're seeing it right now with UFAs, actually. You know, usually the week before the cup final, because not a lot happens during the cup final, but usually you see like a steady stream of settlements and extensions and, you know, both sides agreeing, especially during the flat cap era. It was like, oh, do I really want to even go tomorrow? You know, like,
yep,
I'd rather just stay here. Not just a Canucks thing, like around the league, it feels like the pending UFA list we're looking at right now looks exactly the same as it did 2 months ago. There's a signal in that, right? Like, there's a signal in that. I think a lot of people around the business are very interested to see where salaries go here over the next month. And I'm sure a lot of players and their reps want to find out.
Oh, boy, do they ever. Jason Bukla from Sportsnet's NHL coverage joins us next. He was at the NHL Draft Combine, so we'll get some stories from Bukla on that, get his thoughts on the rest of the NHL Draft, his top prospects list should be dropping in mere minutes on Sportsnet.ca. So we'll talk to Bukla
about
that.
You're a brave man to touch on Bukla's publishing schedule.
That's straight from the man himself. I'm passing that along. So I feel like I'm on solid ground. So we'll talk to Jason Bukla next here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.